a particular pleasure to come back to a place from which I have such very, very good memories. So I'm going to take the offer and make this an invitation for discussion. And by that, in particular, I mean that you should interrupt me and discuss along during the talk instead of just waiting until the end to ask questions and have discussion. So what I'll be telling you about is mainly work done with these people here. So let me start by very, very briefly reminding you about something that you probably don't need to remind it about, but let me just do it anyway. The context of the talk is the gauge string duality. And as you all know, this is an exact equivalence between gauge theories, let's say in flat space, SUNC gauge theories, and some dual string theory in some asymptotically ADS spacetime. The reason the connection with GR appears is because in the large N and strong coupling limit of the gauge theory, the dual side, the string theory, actually reduces to classical gravity or supergravity. And in particular, I'm going to be focusing on the deconfined phase of the gauge theory, namely the phase in which you have a quark gluon plasma. And that's where the connection with black holes arises, because the dual description of that will involve some gravity theory in the presence of a black hole horizon. Basically, what we will be doing is studying the dynamics of these black hole horizons. So I think it's fair to say that over the last decade or so, by using this correspondence, precisely in the terms I described, we have learned a lot about equilibrium and near-equilibrium physics of strongly coupled large-N gauge theory plasmas. In a cartoon way, you could say that we have actually done that by putting perturbations, small perturbations, around spacetimes that have a black hole horizon sitting in them. So for example, by looking at the way these perturbations diffuse momentum, you can compute the viscosity of the strongly coupled plasma, and so on and so forth. And I think, so that has found, the reason many people are interested in that is because we can actually realize experimentally some of these strongly coupled plasmas, whether it's a large N, so I'm talking about, of course, the QCD plasma, the real world QCD plasma that you can measure and study in heavy ion collisions. Whether or not that's a large N plasma, we can discuss. But it certainly seems to be reasonably strongly coupled at the temperatures that you can reach in at RIC and LHC. And about a Fermi after the collision, the plasma seems to be described or to be near equilibrium. And then everything that we learn about these strongly coupled plasmas using duality, in principle, can have implications for the experimental properties of this quark gluon plasma that you create in the lab. So it's clear that we should go one step further and actually address the dynamics, the out-of-equilibrium dynamics, not just near-equilibrium, but out-of-equilibrium dynamics of this plasma, because that's of experimental interest. And more generally, quantum field theory out of equilibrium, really far from equilibrium, is a very, very remarkably difficult subject. But given everything that I said, it's clear that that will map through the duality to the dynamics, now time-dependent and far from equilibrium dynamics, of general relativity in some asymptotically ADS spacetime in the presence of a horizon, if you're interested in the dynamics of the plasma. Are there any questions so far?
So when you say out of equilibrium, what do you mean by that?
I will be much more precise about that, yeah. For the moment, let's take it as a self-explanatory term. Now, one thing that's crucial for, especially, I mean, in general, but also for the purpose of this talk, to remember is that the strict dual of QCD is not going to be a supergravity dual. It's going to be a string theory dual, okay? Because QCD is not strongly coupled all the way up to the ultraviolet. It becomes asymptotically free. And therefore, this region will not be described by supergravity, because supergravity requires strong coupling. And the reason I'm emphasizing this is because at present, you should not be trying to do precision QCD physics using this tool. In particular, you should not expect that anything you compute, of course you can get lucky, but generically you should not expect anything you compute using supergravity to be more than an order one approximation, so subject to an order one error, possibly, to anything that you can measure in real world QCD.
So you have present, you mean that this is not going to be the case for ever?
Well, I can't predict the future.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think.
Do you see hope for?
Yes, I think there is hope for progress,
for
even in the current financial situation.
With
I think there is hope for solving large n QCD. If you want to go to finite n, that's a completely different problem. I think it's much more difficult. But I would also claim that if you solve large n QCD. So I would claim that the main obstacle for making contact with QCD is not, so there are two assumptions in supergravity. One is large N and the other one is strong coupling. And I think the more serious obstacle for making contact with real world QCD is strong coupling. Because large N QCD shares a lot of properties with QCD like asymptotic freedom, confinement, a confining, deconfining transition, and so on and so forth, right? And those we cannot see using so asymptotic freedom is crucial, and we cannot see that in supergravity.
So David, if there is no way to do precision, so when you do experiments of Rick and the time scales are more or less in agreement, as far as thermalization is concerned, with what calculations you can do are, then one could be, so that's usually one of the main examples people give to say, well, look, there is something interesting here because the time scales are very much in agreement. So what would have been a really bad number? Okay, so orders of magnitude different, in which case then you would say this doesn't make any sense?
No, I think people are, in my opinion, foolishly fixated on numbers. I think, and even if you look, for example, so since you ask, this very celebrated viscosity calculation, right, which at strong coupling and large N gives 1 over 4 pi. If you look at the data from RIC and LHC, the current consensus is that from the experiment, it could be somewhere in between 1 and 2.5 times 1 over 4 pi. So let's say it's twice 1 over 4 pi. That means that if you take at face value the calculation from supergravity, you made a prediction which is wrong by 200%. For me, that's a success, because what you're after is the right ballpark. So if you do a perturbative calculation in the regime where you believe it, you probably get 10 times 1 over 4 pi at best. So what I'm trying to say is that you should expect to get insights from this. In particular, if you have no idea how small or large a viscosity at infinite coupling can be, this is a very good tool, because it gives you at least a rigorous calculation in a model. But you should not take the number. If you get a factor of 2 or 3, I don't think you should take that seriously. And also for the thermalization time, the same is true. In perturbative QCD, you can get, say, thermalization times which are maybe 2 Fermi over C. The real one might be, say, 0.5 or 1 Fermi over C. At strong coupling, maybe you get, I don't know, 0.3 or 0.5 or 2. It depends on the model as well. So we're talking about order one numbers, and I don't think you should take those seriously. What you should take seriously are more qualitative features of what the dynamics can look like at strong coupling, which in particular in a dynamical setting you have no idea about. And I think my talk will be an example of the kind of thing that I'm hoping to learn.
Do you think that string operations will be brought under control in the near future or
midterm? Okay, I think one has to go step by step. So first of all, we need to solve the classical string in strictly AVS5. And I think that's doable. I think there's been progress, right? And I think at some point it will be done. Then there's an order of magnitude jump to actually solving that, not in AVS, but in something that's only asymptotically AVS, but that confines in the infrared. That's at least an order of magnitude more difficult. But if you do that, then you can do large N QCD. And then you're really, really in business. So I don't think it's hopeless. Any more questions? Okay, so in particular, my talk has to do with what Luis was mentioning, this not simply the thermalization time in a heavy ion collision, which is what happens in the first, let's say, one Fermi after the collision, but also how thermalization or isotropization takes place, not just how long it takes. And for this talk, my goal is actually very modest. I'm going to start with the simplest possible toy model that you could look at. Because as you will see, there's a distinction between thermalization and isotropization. Thermalization means that you're locally in thermal equilibrium. And therefore, hydrodynamics, with only a few terms, could describe that. Whereas isotropization just means that the pressures become similar. And it's not exactly the same condition. So what I'm going to do is to look at the homogeneous plasma, strongly coupled large chain homogeneous plasma, which is nevertheless, at T equals zero, possibly very highly anisotropic. This means that the pressure in some direction we can call longitudinal can be very different from the pressure in the transverse directions. So because everything is homogeneous, there is not going to be any type of diffusion physics. All that's going to happen is that this pressure will, if it starts it being bigger than this one, it will eventually relax, and you will reach a state at the end in which the two pressures are equal. So this is what I mean by isotropization. And precisely because, as I said, because of this homogeneous assumption, which is simply put there because we want to start with the simplest possible setup and then complicate the story. And I'll tell you at the end, work in progress, about the complications. Because of the homogeneity, if you look at the conservation of the stress tensor in the plasma, that reduces to the statement that the energy density is constant, dt of T00 is zero, which means that as the two pressures wildly, as you will see, they wildly oscillate and eventually relax to the same value, the energy density point-wise is going to be constant. It's not going to change in the process. Okay? Because there's no hydrodynamics, it cannot move around. And this is crucial for this talk because it means that initially we'll specify some initial state which is far from equilibrium, but which has obviously some well-defined energy density. And we know what the energy density after the plasma has relaxed back to equilibrium is going to be. It's the same. So we know from the start the final state to which this initial state will relax to.
So you're presenting this as if it is a check on your numerics, this statement. But it is not, because this is...
I didn't say that, Alex.
Oh, okay.
No.
Maybe I misunderstood.
No. This equation is, of course.
This is something you would end up enforcing when you are solving your Einstein equations.
Yes, this condition on the gauge theory side is implied by Einstein's equations near the boundary, regardless of what's going on in the interior.
Right.
So I am not saying... And this will come up a little later, but I'm not saying this is a check of the numerics. This is actually a boundary condition, as you will see, that you use when you solve for your numerics because you need boundary conditions. I'll be much more explicit about this. And so precisely because of the fact that everything is homogeneous, we are working literally at zero momentum, okay? And that means that there is not going to be any hydrodynamic modes that get excited. Because by definition, hydrodynamic modes are such that their frequency goes to zero as they have a dispersion relation such that omega goes to zero when Q goes to zero. Okay, so these don't get excited. Therefore, what we will be studying is actually the physics only of quasi-normal modes, which I'm distinguishing from hydrodynamic modes, because these are excited. I will be more precise about this later, but these are excitations of the system such that their frequency does not go to zero in the limit in which Q goes to zero. Okay? Yes?
So what would you expect? So in principle, would you expect that maybe this higher quasi or massive mode will eventually source the hydrodynamic mode? And if you were to...
In this case, they cannot, because I'm setting Q equals zero, and that's a consistent thing to do.
Yeah, sure, it's consistent, but would you imagine that if you were to, you know, increase the complexity of the code by factors of and allow for the basically for the queue dependent fluctuations, would you expect that this quasi normal mode would excite?
They will mix. They will mix, yes. And they will couple to each other. And I will come back to this at the end. Yes. Yes. So absolutely, all of these are very good questions. And I'm just postponing them because otherwise I'll run ahead of myself. But I will come back to them, yeah. No, but please do ask them. So essentially, at the end, I'll mention the next step if you want to relax this homogeneity assumption, which, of course, is unphysical. It's just a simplifying assumption for this talk. Any other questions before I get into some details?
Even if this approximation is unphysical, is there any situation where it's a good approximation, where the scales are, where the...
You mean experimentally?
Yeah.
Without...
That's almost homogeneous, but...
So off the top of my head, one thing that you can certainly say is that if you start with something that's very far from equilibrium, these quasi-normal modes will possibly dominate the initial dynamics in that they will relax faster. And then once they have relaxed enough, then the hydrodynamic modes will then dominate the dynamics. And those can be described, presumably, by hydrodynamics. So you will see that in this case, what...
Time scale for homogenization is different from the time scale for isotropization.
Yes.
In such a way that this.
Yes. So, if you start with something that's. So, initially, if you start these quasi normal modes, say some high quasi normal mode far from equilibrium, as you know, this relaxes back very fast as it is determined by its quasi normal frequency. And this relaxation, if it's a high quasi normal mode, can be much faster than the typical time scale. This will depend on how inhomogeneous your system is. If you start with something that's inhomogeneous but has a long wavelength, and also on top of that you have these quasi-normal modes, then the omega, the frequency for this long wavelength hydrodynamic mode, is very small because it goes to 0 when Q goes to 0. So that will evolve slowly, but this other guy will relax fast. So in that case, you can sort of separate the dynamics approximately into the relaxation of the quasi-normal modes and then the hydrodynamic tail. Of course, in a real situation, it depends on your initial state, your initial conditions. And I'm going to explain now how you fix, at least for this case, which is homogeneous, the initial conditions, how you specify the initial state. Good. Any other questions? OK, so let me spend a little bit of time explaining how you actually pose the problem, because what we have to do is to solve some GR equations in asymptotically ADS. So let me explain the causal structure of the problem so that you see that it's well posed. So remember that we are looking at the dynamics. We're going to use gravity to describe the dynamics of a plasma that lives at the asymptotic boundary of this ADS space. Okay, so it will evolve in time here. And because it's homogeneous, there is only dependence on time. Now, here. We know that at late times, we expect that the plasma will settle down to an equilibrium plasma, an isotropic plasma. And therefore, at late times, the solution on the gravity side must have an equilibrium horizon over here. And we know what the solution looks like. If we were in exact isotropic thermal equilibrium, the solution would look like this. It's a black brain, which is isotropic in these directions. It has this blackening factor here. There's a horizon at R0, et cetera, et cetera. Now, if you trace back this event horizon, as you go back in time, you expect that this came from the relaxation of a far from equilibrium event horizon. And so it's clear that one way to specify the initial state is to say this is t equals 0 for the plasma. So let's take a hypersurface, and now ingoing hypersurface like this, which will intersect the horizon somewhere, let's say here. And then let's specify on this initial time slice, which is null, the most general initial state for the five-dimensional metric, and if you had other fields for the rest of the fields, which is compatible with the constraints that come from Einstein's equations. Okay, so the most general consistent initial state for gravity here. And I will explain later that by doing that, you immediately realize that this is a problem that's characterized by an infinite number of different scales. Okay, because this initial state, as you will see, is specified by functions, entire functions defined on this initial time slice, and therefore a function can have an infinite number of scales sitting inside it. I'm emphasizing this so that you keep in mind that it's not just the energy density, the initial energy density that sets the scale. Of course, that's a very important scale, but it's not the only one. In principle, this is an infinitely many-scale problem. Now, it's clear that if I specify the initial state here, and I also specify the boundary conditions on this asymptotic ADS boundary, because I have this horizon here, the dynamics in this region is completely determined because it's in the causal future of this initial time slice together with the boundary conditions. And the boundary conditions that we are going to specify is that there are no sources acting on this plasma. In other words, you set up the plasma by specifying some initial state here, which on the gravity side means here, and then you let it go. And you let it go and relax according to the hydrodynamic, according to whatever the quantum field theory equations over here, without any external sources acting on it. I'm emphasizing this so that you can contrast it with what Chesler and Jaffe do, because this setup is very similar to the one they used. But what they say is, what they do is a different way of constructing an out of equilibrium initial state. What they say is, let's take, if you had vacuum ADS, this would be the Penrose diagram in the Poincaré patch. And then they say, let's imagine that the plasma is in perfect equilibrium up to this point. So by causality, that means that in this region, we have vacuum ADS. And now let's turn on a source in the gauge theory, which breaks isotropy and which excites the plasma more or less violently, depending on how fast the source is changing, et cetera. And we turn it on and off, so it has compact support in time. And therefore, this source now will send in gravitational radiation and so on. So it will create for you an out of equilibrium state here in this region. And once you turn it off, that state will then eventually relax back to equilibrium, and that's what you want to study. Okay, so they specify the initial state by saying that they have vacuum over here, and they create the out of equilibrium state by turning on this source. That's not what we'll do. We'll do what I described here, and well, you'll see the differences, but by doing it this way, I think it gives you a little bit more intuition about what the initial state is, and as you will see, we will be able to actually do statistics, because we actually managed to construct about over 2,000 different initial states here and see how they relax and compute the isotropization times for all of them and then see if there is some regularity and so on and so forth. So this depends on what you mean, but to give you a technical answer, in our case, at t equals 0, so over here, there will already be an event horizon.
Yeah.
Of course, you don't know that until you solve for the evolution and trace back. But there will be one. In their case, if you like, in the Poincaré patch, the moment you put the slightest energy density, you already have an event horizon. So yes, you could say they are creating the horizon, and we already have it. But there's a bit of semantics
so
in that.
So you're asking slightly different questions?
Not really, because in principle, you should be able to match. I mean, I'm giving you the initial state here.
Yes.
But in principle, there should be a way of creating this state by acting with a source on the boundary, in principle, you would imagine on physical grounds.
You mean putting the source before?
Yes.
Like
yeah, so I could take Chesler and Jaffe's setup and now cut it here, look at the state on this slice, and call that my initial time slice. And then certainly that state has been created by this source. Whether or not, for an arbitrary initial state here, you can actually engineer a source that will precisely give you that initial state, that I don't know. That's why I'm saying that if you're trying to sort of study a large number of initial states, I think this method is more convenient. But I don't mean to imply by any means that this is better or worse. I'm just saying that it's different.
But in principle, they of scales that appears on the initial data slide on the right side should also appear in the source terminal data.
I agree, but this is another reason why I was emphasizing that this is an infinitely scaled problem, because here, I think for simplicity, they looked at a specific source, and that source had only one or two couple of numbers in or scales in it that defined the source, right? It was some profile, and then you could change the height and the width. Whereas here, we will really be exploring all these infinitely many scales. We'll construct very different initial states. Of course, you could, in principle, imagine constructing a very complicated source here characterized by 2,000 different parameters, and then seeing if there is some regularity in the subsequent evolution. But they didn't do that.
But are you going to go back at some point and ask, you know, of those, you know, different profiles you can choose on your red line, this class is, you know, more reasonable for the physics that I'm interested in?
Which is the physics you're interested in?
Well, you motivated it with Rick.
For Rick, I'm not yet going to make that jump, because I think in order to do that, you should include the hydrodynamic modes. Because at Rick, for example, as you know, the dynamics is much more complicated,
sure,
than what I'm describing. So I think it's a bit premature at this point to try to make contact. We can discuss it.
Yeah.
And at the end, I will tell you that one way to modify this so that you can start making contact is, instead of looking at homogeneous plasmas, looking at boost invariant plasmas, which do have hydrodynamics in their dynamics. So for the moment, you will see in a few slides what the real motivation is here, is to actually motivate a approximation that could work. It certainly works very well in this case, but it could, my expectation or my hope is that it will work well in much more complicated situations. And in those situations, it's a dramatic simplification. So then you could look at something that looks much more realistic and use this approximation to actually learn something about the dynamics. So the goal here is not so much yet to present a semi-realistic model, but to actually present a model that's simple enough to see how well this approximation works, and then try to go step by step, seeing if it still works when you do more realistic setups.
Initial data approach, whereas, I mean, they are plain like the experimental, where you set up your experiment, you want to have control over your research data.
Me or them?
No, them.
Them.
Then, but then you're saying, well, just play all possible games and see what comes out.
Yeah. I think, Rob, one of the things is that if you want to compare these initial states with the ones in a heavy ion collision.
No, I don't really. I just want to say that not all states are equal.
I agree.
I can build something.
I agree. Okay, let me just make one more comment so that you're not too disappointed. No. Let me make it. So one of the things that these infinitely many scales here have to do with where exactly along this direction you put your anisotropy, your initial anisotropy. And that in the gauge theory has to do with what's the characteristic momentum scale or energy scale of the mode that actually has mainly is carrying this initial anisotropy. So you can certainly argue that, for example, you don't want to put it too close to the horizon, because that means that you're putting it in a mode that has such a long wavelength that it will not fit in your initial fireball. Okay? So certainly, we can look at initial states that have this anisotropy deposited very close to the horizon. And those ones actually have a very long isotropization time, because that perturbation has to propagate out to the boundary so you can see it in the stress tensor. But those long isotropization times are probably cut off in the real fireball by the fact that you cannot put an infinitely long wavelength excitation in this, because it's finite volume quark gluon plasma that you're creating. So that's certainly things that you can try to make contact with. But this is not going to be the focus here.
So if I just think about from the point of view of statistics, right, if I understand what you're doing, instead of putting some physically reasonable source, right, you're putting sort of a statistics of initial conditions. Why would they need to thermalize? If I'm doing a dynamical system, and I said, or you're picking a particular set of initial conditions.
So let me make two comments. First of all, I disagree with Well, I disagree. This is not my work, but you can call this a reasonable initial source. And
reasonable or not reasonable, but it's a source.
No, but that's just a semantics or a matter of opinion. But what you would, if you want to try to make contact with the experiment, what you're really interested in is what Rob was asking, which is, what would in this description something that's more or less generic in a heavy ion collision look like? And that we don't know. We don't know if by acting with this source, you're creating something that's completely atypical or actually very representative. Yeah. We have no idea. Of course, this source looks simple in this description, but it might not have anything to do.
No, I agree with that.
Okay.
I'm asking about this, if I were to take...
Why would it thermalize?
Why?
If I start with a bunch of molecules on one corner here and let them go, you agree they will thermalize, right?
I know, but you see, presumably you're restricting this set. It's not just any set of initial conditions.
No, I'm going to, except for the limitation of numerical precision and stability and so on.
So you
but
assume
that's,
that basically you're sampling the whole space.
What I'm going to give you is, on the gravity side, the construction, at least in theory, of the most general possible initial state. Okay. Of course, that may not capture in full generality what could happen in the gauge theory, because I'm in this limit of very strong coupling and large n. But in that limit, it's the most general thing. And you will see with your eyes that it thermalizes.
I think there is a point in the question, something that I'm confused about. I can say some words just to point that. In principle, we expect that if the system is integrable, it would not thermalize, right? So because there are infinitely many conserved charges, and so you specify an initial state by providing, the values of this infinite set of conserved charges, and they would stay constant. And so, well, Pedro is here, so he will tell you that n equals 4 is integrable, at least in infinite hood cup. Well, in a planar limit, right? so then the question becomes: so how come we do see some normalization? It could be large n effect, but aside from these sort of general words, it's an interesting question. What's your take on
that?
Basically repeating what George was asking.
I have no problem with integrability. I agree. N equals 4 is probably
integrable.
Wait.
Yeah.
I think the gravity description is just capturing, in this case, an approximate description of the system in the same sense that, of course, if you put a bunch of molecules and you start with an initial state, you know it will evolve. And for a long time, it will look thermal, for a very long time. But if you wait long enough, it was a pure state, so eventually it will go back, okay, to looking something very non-thermal.
Well, you're not going to say the same on the gravity. Once you form
no,
horizon,
because I'm missing, of course, but
state.
Of course, but this is because there is a horizon. And once you fall through a horizon, classically, you cannot come out. And that's a bit of physics that we don't understand. Okay? So I'm not going to solve that puzzle here. That's way beyond, that's a completely different question. Okay? But I think it is also the same question as what I described. It has nothing to do, I mean, on the gravity side, you see it because of the black hole horizon. But you could ask the same question about a system that looks thermal for a long time, but you know eventually will not.
Just to make a point here, that you can play games like this. And for example, you can introduce additional global charge and sort of repeat the same problem. An additional global charge could be something that when people discuss boson stars in GR. So that will produce you sort of conserved quantity. And you will see in that case that some of the states actually do not thermalize.
In fact, all this discussion has nothing to do with integrability. Because...
Let me finish. Charges that will not
Alex,
thermalize.
Let me finish.
Yeah, sure.
Even if the gauge theory is not integrable, if you start with a pure state, okay, you will not end up with a thermal state. You know that. It doesn't have anything to do with integrability. It's just a pure state evolves unitarily into a pure state. Now, perhaps what I'm doing here is by using this classical gravity description, what I'm actually specifying is some sort of density matrix, okay, initially. This may not correspond to a pure state over here initially. And I cannot really see that because I'm using this limited description. So I agree with all these comments, but I think they apply in a much more general setting beyond what I'm describing.
Well, I don't know how you would set up a pure state to begin with. I think you're always sort of setting up something, as you said, sort of a density matrix. You would need, an infinite fine-tuning to make sure you were setting up a
no, I'm state. Okay. I'm happy with setting up here whatever it is that corresponds to this initial state on the gravity side. I agree it's a limited description.
No, it's not any.
And also, by the way, in QCD, in fact, QCD is probably not integral, real world QCD, yet you collide these two heavy ions and you form something that for quite a while looks thermal. Of course it's not, right? It's a pure state because you started with a pure state and eventually you recover a pure state. So you can ask this question precisely in that context, has nothing to do with gravity. Okay, and nothing to do with integrability.
Yeah, and that's the reason why I think it's interesting to ask this question in the gravity, because people in quantum field theory do not know the answer to that question.
Okay, but you're asking a question that's extremely interesting, but way beyond the scope of my talk.
No, it's just.
And I don't disagree with anything you said. Any other disagreements?
I'm kidding.
Any other questions? Okay. So the last comment is that because we're doing pure gravity in ADS, this actually applies for a large class of CFTs, not just n=4, but a very large class of theories. Okay. So as you may guess from the fact that I'm specifying the state in this initial null hypersurface, we'll use this generalized Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates. And the thing to note is that the metric, so rho is this direction here, which is null. And then the rest of the metric is completely specified by three functions, A, sigma, and B. So x longitudinal and x transverse are these directions along which, in the gauge theory, along which the pressures can be different. And then the metric is completely specified by three functions of t and rho only. Remember, in the gauge theory, there is only time dependence because everything is homogeneous. In the bulk, you have this additional radial coordinate. Okay? So the goal of the numerical analysis is to determine these functions given initial data on this hypersurface. Now, in equilibrium, these functions look like this because this is just a black brain in ADS. And in particular, B is 0 because B measures the anisotropy between these two directions. Now, coming back to this question that Alex asked before about the energy density being constant here, remember that you have to solve these Einstein's equations subject to appropriate boundary conditions near ADS because we're doing holography. And then this is the follow-up with the radial direction that you have to consider. And this A4, as you see, is a constant. And this is implied by Einstein's equations near the boundary. Whereas this other constant, B4 here, can depend on time. And once you, if you are able to solve Einstein's equations in the bulk with these boundary conditions, then you can read off A4 and B4 of T, and they determine, by holography, the stress tensor, the evolution in time of the stress tensor in the boundary theory. So for example, the energy density is up to a constant is this A4, and it is constant, and B, in particular, the falloff, the leading term in this falloff, determines the difference in pressures, P transverse minus P longitudinal, as a function of time. So once you determine this this function of time, you know the anisotropy.
So your boundary conditions are the leading terms? It's at
yeah.
A equal rho squared, B equals 0, and sigma equals 0.
Sigma goes like rho.
Like rho.
So this is the non-normalizable modes.
Okay.
This is the normalizable mode. By the way, Okay, so Einstein's equations, when you write the metric in this form, look like this. There are five of them, where H, where prime and dot denote derivatives along ingoing or outgoing null geodesics, so they are adapted to the problem. And I should emphasize that these three first equations are dynamical equations, whereas these two here are constraints in the sense that, for example, if you take the time derivative of this one, that is zero, and that's implied by these first three dynamical equations. And that means that if this equation here is satisfied on this initial time slice, it will be satisfied at some later, any later time slice. So you only need to impose it here. And then this other one has zero radial derivative. So if it's satisfied near the boundary, it will also be satisfied in the interior. So the first one is a constraint on the possible initial states. The second one is a constraint on your boundary conditions. But if you impose the right boundary conditions and you choose an initial state that's consistent with this, then with these three other equations, you can determine the subsequent evolution. And in particular, you see from this equation that if you specify b as a function of rho at t equals 0 here, because this equation only has prime derivatives, it only involves derivatives in this direction, you can then solve for sigma at t equals 0. Once you know that, you can go here and solve for sigma dot. And once you know that, you go here and solve for b dot. All of those evaluated at t equals 0. And once you have all of that, you go here and you solve for a here. Okay, so now you have all your data here, and you can then take one step in your numerical evolution and compute it a little bit later and repeat the process and so on and so forth. So that's the way you can integrate the equations numerically. And the thing to emphasize is that the most general initial state in this setup is completely specified, from what I said, by giving this function b as a function of rho. So it's one function of one variable. Okay, that's the most general initial state. And of course, because it's a completely arbitrary function of rho, it has infinitely, in principle, infinitely many scales in it.
So, yep. So, just from the GR side, when the numerical branches here know that even though in principle the initial data should be preserved upon evolution, in practice it doesn't happen.
Yes, but we monitor that over the
so
evolution.
So, you put in some constraint dumping with the evolutions?
No. This particular structure has it for free because you're iterating along characteristics, so all the garbage,
this has been
seen before, and also in the 3 plus 1 case, it just goes into the horizon.
Just
yeah,
it's
I should.
Not couple, as couple as in the Cauchy.
Yeah, I should have said that. So, this characteristic formulation, of course, in this very, very specific context, is what Chesley and Jaffe realized that is very useful to use because it simplifies dramatically the numerics.
You don't.
No, so in this particular case, because the assumption is not going to happen, but in the general case, that's the main obstacle for applying this approach in all cases of interest.
Yeah, that's right. In this case, it doesn't happen, but yeah, how general a setup will be in which you can use this formulation is not completely clear. Now, the fact that to specify the initial state, you have to give an entire function is not surprising, because in the CFT, it's not enough to specify the initial state to say this is the difference in pressures at t equals 0. You have to say this difference in pressures, how is that distributed over the different energy scales or different modes in the gauge theory. Okay, so now I'm coming to this simplifying assumption that we want to test, which is the following. We know, as I said initially, that at very late times, this will settle down to an equilibrium state, which is given by this metric. Okay, these are the functions, the value of the functions in the metric I showed before, where the only parameter is this temperature T, which is related to the energy density. Okay, T is basically the energy density to 1/4. Now, I know this T from the beginning, if you give me this initial state, because I know the initial energy density, and I know it's going to be the same as the late time energy density. So I know the late time form of the solution, or the equilibrium solution to which it will relax. So now we do two things. For each of these over 2,000 initial states, we do two things. One is we take the state and we evolve the full nonlinear Einstein equations with that initial state, and we see what we get. In particular, we see what the anisotropy as a function of time looks like. And the other thing we do is we take this initial state and we view it because we decide to do so, as a perturbation of this final state. Okay? So we linearize Einstein's equations around this equilibrium black brain metric, and then we take the initial state and we evolve it according to the linearized equations. So we do, we solve the full, we evolve the full equations and the linear equations, where linear means linear around this. Okay? Now, the motivation for doing this, I will come back in a second to whether or not you should expect this to be a good approximation, but the motivation comes from something called the closed limit approximation, which arose in the context of black hole collisions in four-dimensional asymptotically flat general relativity. And I think there are people in the audience who know infinitely more than me about this, so I'm very happy to get feedback or comments. But let me just tell you very naively what my understanding is. Suppose you collide two black holes in asymptotically flat four-dimensional space-time. Then once they are close enough, you expect that there will, a common horizon will form around both of them. Then what you do is you view this initial common horizon as a perturbation around the final black hole state that you know the system will settle to roughly, okay? Because if you assume that the system will not radiate a huge amount of its mass in forms of in the form of gravitational radiation, then if you know the masses of the incoming black holes, you know approximately the mass of the final black hole, approximately at least. So you know that it will settle down to some black hole with that mass and possibly some angular momentum, also given by the impact parameter, okay? So roughly speaking, you know the quantum numbers of the final state. And then you view this initial common horizon as a perturbation of this final state. Now, this is something that, at least at first sight, is surprising that you can do this. Because why should this initial common horizon be a small perturbation of the final one? But nevertheless, you say you close your eyes and you insist that you view it as a perturbation. And then what you do is you evolve the linear Einstein's equations, linearized around this final equilibrium black hole, okay? And it turns out that at least if you're interested in what is the form of the gravitational radiation that you measure at infinity, or the waveform, if you like, that is quite well predicted by this linear approximation, which in effect means that, for example, you could just say that this thing, this common horizon, will relax according to a few quasi-normal frequencies in practice. Okay? Now, why this linear approximation should capture well, quite accurately, this gravitational radiation at infinity, when this collision can be very, in principle, generic, is something that, as far as I can tell from asking people, is not 100% sharply understood. Okay? But let me not elaborate too much on this and run with it, and we can discuss whether it should be the case or not at the end, right?
People don't use linearized approximations. They take the amplitudes to be small, or they take the amplitudes large, and then they evolve them with the linear equation.
They don't care what the amplitudes are. What you do, that's my point, that, of course, if you tell me that this initial common horizon is a small, whereby small I mean small in amplitude, perturbation around the final state, then I know that the quasi-normal modes will describe the ringing down.
So the question is that even if you take the amplitude,
yes,
large,
yes. And we will see that, in fact, in our setup in ADS. The amplitude can be very, very large, and yet the linear approximation works very, very well.
But now I'm confused. So I thought the initial data states you were considering were essentially incoming radiation. You only have a single black hole in your space, or black brain in your space, and you're sort of throwing in a bunch of modes, perturbing it, and then observing the radiation that it's in. So it's not like you have two black holes.
That's correct, that's correct. But you will see where the analogy is not in this initial phase in which you have these incoming black holes. The analogy starts the moment you form the common horizon. This common horizon is a single horizon, which is exactly the analog. In this case, it's compact. In our case, it's an infinite, it's a non-compact initial horizon, but it can be very out of equilibrium. This is my point, that this initial common horizon is not approximately spherical.
But in your setup, there's no common anything, it's just.
Absolutely, random. Absolutely. But I will come back at the end, but that's because I'm doing a very simplified model in which the plasma is infinitely extended. At the end, I will show you where I think all of this is going and why I think it might be useful. For the moment, let me tell you the results for this simple case, and then I will put it in a more general context at the end. Okay? But you will see the analogy with this picture. And also, before I move on, let me say that the analog of this gravitational radiation at infinity, in our case, is precisely the stress tensor in the gauge theory, because that's something you read off near the boundary in ADS. So the point is that here, suppose that you wanted to predict with this linear approximation, this closed limit approximation, what the metric is, say, at some distance, finite distance from the system. My guess is that it might actually not be well reproduced by this linear approximation. Yet, or I mean, general observables will not be, but yet the information at infinity, that's well reproduced. That's important. Because in our case, we will reproduce well the boundary stress tensor, but other observables, more complicated observables like two-point functions, other things, Wilson loops and so on, probably will not be well reproduced. Okay, so I'm not claiming that this is good for everything. Any other questions? Okay, so let me tell you the results then. Okay, this is the history in time of the evolution of one single state, but it's representative of what you get. So in this plot, what you have is time going from 0 to approximately somewhat over 1 in units of 1 of the temperature. Okay, the one of the final temperature of the plasma. Over here, this is the radial direction. We are using z over z horizon, where z is 1 over rho. So the horizon here is sitting at z equals zh, so at 1 in this plot. And this thing here is the boundary. That's the horizon. This is the boundary of ADS, where you want to read off the falloff of your fields to extract the stress tensor. And what's plotted here is basically this b, this function b of rho and t, remember, which is what you have to determine to read off the anisotropy. And it's plotted in units of the initial energy density, which is the same as at the end, and also 1 over z to the fourth. And that's because, remember, the falloff of this b goes like b4 of t over z to the fourth. Okay, so the coefficient b4 is the term that multiplies 1 over z to the fourth. And that's what I'm trying to say, is that this quantity here is precisely delta p, the anisotropy difference as a function of time divided in units of the energy density. Okay, that's why it's plotted with this normalization. And this red curve here is b at t equals 0. Remember this function of rho that specifies the initial state. So you see here that we've just chosen somewhat oscillating smooth initial state. But you can choose, as I said, we chose over 2,000 initial states. Some of them oscillate wildly. Some of them are peaked near the infrared. Some of them are peaked near the UV, and so on and so forth. Okay.
This is the nonlinear result.
Oh. Wait. So the blue, yeah. So this B is the result of the nonlinear evolution. I will show in a second the difference with the linear evolution for B. But here already the blue line, okay, which is the intersection of this surface with z equals 0, which is the boundary, that's the full delta p of t. The other line, the magenta line, is the result of the linear evolution. Okay, so you see that the linear evolution falls almost on top of the nonlinear evolution for the observable you're interested in, which is the stress tensor at the boundary. Okay. Now, in the interior, this is the same plot as before. Now here, this is delta b, meaning b of t and rho from the full nonlinear evolution minus b of t and rho from the linear evolution. And you see that, of course, it's centered around 0, but it oscillates. It doesn't follow exactly the nonlinear result. But remember, if you look at the scales of the plots, you see that the scale here is up to 10. The scale here is up to 2. So this means that the accuracy, this already gives you a result. I'll be more precise in a second. But this already gives you an estimate of the accuracy, which is more or less 20%. Okay, because the error you make is 2 over 10. Yes. This is just for this. I'm illustrating in detail the results for a specific initial state. But in a second, I will show you many more plots for very different initial states. And you will see, in fact, the reason I'm showing this is because it's representative. It's generic.
But in the closed limit case, if you were to start a black hole solution far away, then
But again,
break down as you increase the amplitude.
No, this is the point. That you could have thought, and I thought, that there's no way the closed limit approximation can generically give you a good result, because if I collide my initial black holes with an impact parameter that's large, for example, the initial common horizon that I'm going to form is going to be so different from a spherical horizon, or approximately spherical horizon, that I cannot really view that as a perturbation of the spherical horizon. The point is, that's not true. Okay? The closed limit approximation works. The point is, my intuition is that horizons are somewhat stiff, and you cannot really form an initial horizon that's as deformed as you would like. You simply do not form it dynamically. Okay? And here you will see it, because here you have even more freedom. Here you can specify the most general initial state. Okay? There's nothing more general than this. It's not that you're not colliding your objects with a sufficiently, you know, insufficient generality. Here you're constructing the most general initial state.
Right, but so I guess you're putting a amount of time that there is going to be a common apparent horizon. So in the closed limit, you can increase the separation enough that, you know,
right,
they won't merge.
No,
you said enough that the break.
Look, listen, if you don't form a common event horizon, I have nothing to say.
Right.
Okay?
This has been also seen by the simulations that Franz would show with Hans.
No.
But in the past, we actually did something very similar to this in the context of 3+1, just asking at what point can you procure a black hole, and also within the characteristic approach, to see nonlinear mode generation. And it was solid, it was very difficult, but if you actually want to be very pervasive and you choose your B function to be extremely peaked and towards farther out, what you're saying is that, okay, this collision happened, and somehow there was a strong package of gravitational waves outside, and that is sufficiently self-gravitating that we come and introduce a perturbation of order one. Otherwise, the linear approximation, once the single horizon, the common horizon was formed, then it just worked fine.
Again, let me emphasize it again. What I will suggest as a program here at the end is that you can, well, let me not run ahead of myself, okay? Let me finish this, and then I'll get into where I think this is going, because I think it will answer all these questions. Yes.
So the equations that you had are fairly simple. So you could try to compare the linear equations to the nonlinear equations and see what are the terms that are passing.
Very good. Very good. This is, yes. So this is work in progress. I simply haven't had time to do it. But there's a lot of things you can do here to try to understand, to really beat to death this example and see why the linear approximation is working. And let me just say that it's not, you would have naively said, it's going to work as long as this b, remember, in equilibrium, b is 0. So you could have said, as long as b is small, the initial b is small, this will work well. And if b is large, it will not. OK, this is not true. OK, this is way too simplistic. It works well beyond what you are entitled to expect. And I will, let me also get to that.
No, but I think that compared to the cases that people have worked in, well, the equations are much more complicated. You have fairly simple set of equations.
Yes, and we will complicate them. Let me describe the results, and then I'll try to explain how they generalize to more complicated cases, and in the very long term, why I think it could be useful, why we are doing this. Okay, one thing to emphasize is that this initial state may or may not have, so there may or may not be an apparent horizon on this initial time slice. There is always an event horizon that you know a posteriori once you have solved for the evolution, but you can evolve it whether or not there's an apparent horizon, and that's fine.
Have you done that?
Have I done what?
Have you started with a situation where you don't have an initial apparent horizon?
Yes. Out of these 2,000 initial profiles,
okay,
some of them had it, some of them didn't have it, but that's not a problem. And also, let me emphasize one more thing. To make it clear once and for all that this is really far from equilibrium dynamics, it's actually simplest to see in the gauge theory. So you could have expected that the plasma will relax back according to linear response theory, okay, which is the linear approximation, whenever the difference in pressures at t equals 0 or over the evolution in units of the energy density, because remember, this is a conformal field theory. So you have to measure everything in units of the energy density or in units of something. So it's only dimensionless ratios that make sense. So whenever this delta P over epsilon is very small compared to 1, you're guaranteed that the plasma will evolve linearly. And on the gravity side, the same is true. What's surprising is that you see here delta P over the evolution is of order 10. And in fact, we have examples in which it's of order 50 or 100. And yet, the linear evolution works just as well. Okay, so you're definitely seeing that the linear evolution describes well far from equilibrium dynamics.
So you mentioned that people don't understand in detail why this works for certain observables. But what's the intuition? Why would this work for, let's say, if you look at the energy momentum density?
Okay. Because I'll sort of sidetrack in different directions. But we have thought about this, even though I cannot give you a completely crisp answer, but I think I can say a few
things. Because this would be definitely examples of this very, very far from equilibrium from a field theory point.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I mean, in a sense here.
The response has to break down. But perhaps there's something funky happening.
I would have agreed with you, but it doesn't seem to break down. I will discuss this, I promise. Okay. So just a couple more slides, and I will come to the general discussion. So if you look at the area of the event horizon, you can follow that as a function of time. And you see that this is, again, for some initial state. I think it's the previous one, actually. You see that it starts in units of the area at equilibrium, the final area. This starts off at 0.2, and of course, you reach 1 here. So you see that the area of the event horizon increases by a factor of 5. Okay, so definitely there is, if you like, entropy production, or you're going from a low entropy state to a high entropy state, even though, of course, you can only speak strictly of entropy near equilibrium. But you expect that it has something qualitatively to do with entropy. And this, for example, this is a case in which the initial state had no apparent horizon, okay, at least within our grid, it didn't have it. It could have been deeper in the grid. But within our grid, you see it appear here. Okay, and of course, it's behind the event horizon, as you would expect. And eventually, the two areas match. And now this is statistics. So let me say what this is. This is constructed as follows. You take all these initial states, you evolve them in time, and you measure what is the isotropization time for each of them, meaning how long it takes from t equals 0 for the difference in pressures, the anisotropy in units of the energy density, to be below 0.1. This 0.1 is, of course, arbitrary. You could say it's some small number. Okay, it's your definition of what you call approximately isotropic. And the results don't change much. Then you take each of them. You have the isotropization time. And you also compute the isotropization time according to the full evolution and the linear evolution. So you have two different isotropization times, okay? And you look at the difference between the two. And then on this plane, you have isotropization time according to full evolution and difference between the full and the linear evolution. So each of the initial states gives you this pair of linear and full isotropization times. So it falls somewhere on this plane. Is this clear? And then you put in different bins all your states according to these two numbers that you compute for each of them. And you get a plot that looks like, you know, something that the experimentalists plot in collisions, right? But it's not. Yes.
No, I was going to ask, are you going to say something about how you chose your sample?
Yes, I can tell you how. So the way we chose it was the following. Most of the states are generated by taking the ratio of two polynomials in Z, or in rho, of order 10, with randomly generated coefficients. So what we wanted was to generate. I am not claiming by any means that this way of generating something that looks random and generic actually looks generic when you're thinking about states that are created in a real heavy ion collision. I'm not claiming that. All we're trying to do is to generate a large number of initial states here algorithmically. And also, in case those are not generic enough, by hand, we also constructed states that are either very oscillatory in the radial direction or that are peaked near the infrared or mainly supported near the UV or supported in both or a number of bumps in between. So we tried to do everything we could think of compatible with this initial, with the constraint, and then look at the evolution of all of those. And this is what you get. And the point to see, to emphasize, is that first of all, you see that this delta t, which is the error between the estimate for the isotropization time in the linear approximation and the exact one, is centered at zero. So most states, for most states, the linear approximation predicts quite well. In fact, you see within 20%, because they are centered between here and here, okay, which is 0.2. Within 20%, the isotropization time. You also see that most of them are centered around an isotropization time of about 0.67 or so in units of 1 over the temperature. So this gives you an estimate for the typical isotropization time in units of 1 over t, which is what Luis was referring to at the beginning, that you want to know in strong coupling how long it takes to isotropize. And even you see some states, so some states have short isotropization times, and that's just because initially they are very peaked near the boundary. So it takes a short time for the perturbation to reach the boundary and give you the stress tensor. And then once the perturbation bounces off the boundary and falls back, you don't see that in your stress tensor. Okay? So, and even this state, for example, this one here, for which the linear approximation seems to mispredict the isotropization time by a larger error, which is about 60% or so, the reason for that is that this is the full time evolution, not just the isotropization time. And here there are two curves. The blue line is the exact result, and the red line is the linear result. And of course, what's happening is that you started this state had an initial anisotropy that was very, very large. It was 30 in units of the energy density. So the linear approximation predicts quite well the full evolution. But of course, at the end, it just misses. But notice that the scale here is 1. Versus 30. So in units of the initial anisotropy, it misses this little bump by very little. But because our definition of isotropization time is this one here, this makes a big difference, well, of order 60%, in how you estimate the isotropization time in the linear, which is the red curve, approximation, and in the exact evolution. Is this clear?
So then the curves that clearly move away from agreement in the linear regime,
actually, I am not 100% sure. I would have to look at what these ones are, but certainly this one, which I took because it's the one that seems to get the worst prediction, it certainly started with a large anisotropy. But now I'll show you in the next slide many more different initial states, and you'll see a little bit what they look like. Okay, so this is just one.
Is there a clustering of initial state types?
Here? No, this actually, they can look quite differently, quite different from each other. Yeah, yeah. It's not that here they all look the same, and of course they all give the same prediction. No, they're quite different. They can be quite different.
Is it true, for example, that all the ones that have, some property, like, for example, you pick them all in the infrared, lead to more points in the diagram in one sector of the space?
Yes, but not in terms of the error you make. So not in this direction, but in this one. So if you pick them, if you're, let me maybe. So the point is that, so this is your initial slice, right? If your state is peaked here, right? So the delta B has support very near the horizon. What happens is that for you, so initially, when you measure your delta P here, so your plot, delta P, here will be approximately zero because you don't see the anisotropy yet. You have to wait for this to propagate out and hit the boundary. So this will look like this, and then you will see the anisotropy hitting you. So of course, the isotropization time measured by definition, we measure it from the initial, from t equals zero here, will be longer if your roughly speaking, if your anisotropy is supported in the infrared initially. Okay? Whereas if it's supported here, it immediately it hits you, and then it isotropizes.
So if you were to shift about the peak, then do you get the same time?
I'm not sure about that. I think it's a bit more complicated. I mean, roughly speaking, perhaps, but I'm not sure.
But if you go out on that wing and you look at profiles rather than delta T, is there some here? The one with larger error?
Here?
Yeah. Is there some common for the profiles?
Yeah, for the profiles. Yeah, yeah. Yes. We have actually more correlation. We have actually tried to look for correlations between any possible observable you could imagine here with the delta B and the whole thing. And this will appear in a longer paper, but I don't remember off the top of my head, and I haven't actually thought as carefully about that. But that was one of the things we wanted to do, which is to experimentally to discover correlations. For example, between the initial entropy density, how close to the final one that is, and how long it takes to isotropize, things like this. So all the quantities you can measure, we have plotted them on two-dimensional plots to see correlations. And in some cases, you find them. In some other cases, you don't. So in some time, I will be able to say more about this. But right now, I don't remember off the top of my head. But there are certainly some correlations, yeah.
In the case where the linearized approximation and the non-linear study differ the most, what's the difference in the value of the horizon area towards the end? Because one easy way to make these two numbers be very, very different is to have the final black hole mass to be very different in the fully nonlinear case and in the linear case, because then the quasi-normal frequency of both would be completely different. So that's why I'm asking. So
you said the mass, you said?
Yeah, the event horizon area that I have towards the end.
The area.
Right.
The area,
so
yes.
Make them such that, so in the linearized case, it's fixed by your initial value. And the R1 will grow depending on how much energy you throw in. But if you throw
Wait,
in...
You said true. I thought it fixed the mass of the hole to be the final one.
Okay.
Oh,
so,
so if I just make a huge change, then I'm going to see a huge difference.
Yeah, to make the discussion clear, you have to remember that this problem has more parameters than the mass. So the mass would be the energy density, which is fixed. So what you're throwing into the black hole is not additional mass because the energy is fixed. What you're throwing in is an isotropy. Okay, it's a perturbation that carries an isotropy. Well, okay.
Black hole area grows.
The black hole area grows. So you're throwing energy into the black hole. What I mean is the total energy of the space-time is fixed.
No, I'm looking at black hole area.
Rob was looking very uneasy about my statement.
What's the worst growth?
So typically, what I showed you here is actually quite typical. So about a factor of 5 increase in the area. Maybe we can go a little below that. But it becomes hard, actually, to start with initial profiles that have very, very low below.
A
factor of 5. And yet, the linear approximation for this one, if I remember correctly, is actually this one. Okay. So you see that everywhere in space-time, you get the prediction for B within 20%. And near the boundary, you see that it follows very well.
So what's the cube root?
What's
the cube root of
5? 125, no?
Okay, then you're changing things. Your mass scale would change only by 125. So then.
No, the cube root, sorry.
Right. And then trying to say, well, the mass, so the quasi normal mode would depend on the mass of the black hole. You only change the mass of the black hole by 1.
No. I disagree with this way of understanding things. Let me. I think the message you have to take home is. Suppose you've never heard about it. Let me actually get to this. Sorry. So the one thing I want to convey is you should be surprised. You definitely should be surprised. OK. So let me just say one more slide, and then I'll come to the.
Just before you go, in the previous plot,
yeah.
The typical isotropization time that you get, is it compatible with the result that Paul and Larry got? Or it's very different?
It's different. Well, OK. No, everything. No, 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 wait, wait.
Your function was not very representative.
No, everything is a number of order 1 times 1 over t.
Right.
I think more than comparing the numbers, what you should ask is about the mechanism. And the mechanism is different because of the way you specify the initial state. Because if I understand correctly, the way they understand this isotropization or thermalization is that you have this source on the boundary. It creates some radiation. And thermalization, the thermalization times is the time it takes the radiation to fall through the black hole. Here is actually the opposite, because the isotropization time is the time it takes the perturbation you put in to propagate out to the boundary, which perhaps is the same thing for some states, but it's not always the same thing.
The typical value, about 0.6.
No, the typical value is one, always order 1/T. Yes. In fact, maybe the question you should ask is whether it's well determined by the lowest quasi-normal mode frequency. And the answer is no. And the reason it's not is because if you only excited the lowest quasi-normal mode, or only one of them, then it's true that the relaxation, if you believe that the linear approximation applies, would be given by one of the imaginary part of the frequency. Well, actually, let me not get into this. If I have time, I'll mention it at the end, but let me not do it. Let me just say that indeed, in the linear approximation, you can certainly expand the perturbation in quasi-normal modes. And then, of course, the linear, if you include all the quasi-normal modes, you should get recover the exact linear approximation. So here what you see is for a large number, well, for some sample of initial states, you see three curves in each plot. So you see the anisotropy is a function of time. The blue line is the full result. The red line is the linear approximation without any further approximations or truncations. And the green line is the linear approximation when you truncate it to the first, say, 10 or 20 quasi-normal modes. Okay? Of course, this is a good description of the linear approximation as long as your initial B is not exciting the quasi-normal mode number 50, right? Because then you're not going to capture that with the first. Anyway, this is just to show that indeed you can do the quasi-normal mode analysis and so on. And now let me come to the discussion, okay? So let's take a step back. In the gauge theory, you know that if you take a plasma in perfect equilibrium and you put a small perturbation on it, this can be described in what's called linear response theory, okay? Which basically is the analysis of the quasi-normal modes for the small perturbations of the plasma. On the gravity side, again, if you take a black brain in perfect equilibrium, you put a small perturbation, you know that the linear Einstein-Sense equations will give you a good description, and in particular, the quasi-normal modes will determine the ring down. Now, it's clear in the gauge theory that you should expect this linear response theory to work whenever the anisotropy carried by the perturbation is small in units of the energy density. If it's not, what you're putting in is not a small perturbation. You're actually deforming the plasma really far away from equilibrium. Now, in Fourier space, I already explained that you have the hydrodynamic modes and the quasi-normal modes. And therefore, what we have studied, actually, what everything I have said, can be thought of as trying to study the far from equilibrium dynamics of these quasi-normal modes. Okay? Now, again, if the perturbation is small, you know that the quasi-normal modes evolve linearly and independently from each other. Okay, this is what the linear approximation is. And the relaxation time is given by one of the imaginary part of the corresponding quasi-normal frequency. Now, suppose that you start with a small perturbation, then this is a good description. How would you imagine extending this description beyond the regime in which the perturbation is small? Well, you have a set of independent quasi-normal modes, which at first order evolve independently and linearly. How do you extend that? Well, you start adding mixing terms and interactions between these modes, and presumably this can take you somewhat beyond the small perturbation limit, perhaps to delta P over epsilon of order 1. But you should expect this description built upon the lowest approximation, which is the linear approximation in terms of quasi-normal modes, to break down at some point, okay, beyond this of order 1. The point here is that it does not. Okay, you can go to this of order 100, and this description, actually even without including these interactions between the quasi-normal modes, gives you an accurate description within 20%. That's the point. And this means that even very, very far away from equilibrium, the relaxation, at least in the homogeneous case, is still characterized by just a few quasi-normal frequencies.
This has also been seen
asymptotically. Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, this was part of the inspiration, at least for me, for actually seeing if this works in ADS.
I mean, beyond the loss limit, I mean, like, in polymer.
Yes. And I believe that maybe France will also mention this. I think you also see this in ADS, right? So, and in fact, your talk in Madeira, I remember some plots with where were you saying that the lowest one or two quasi-normal modes are enough. Yeah, okay, so that was very inspirational for me. Okay, and then just to emphasize again that this linear approximation is probably, at least in this case, is good for the one-point function of the stress tensor. It might not be good for other observables. And now, what would be the next step? The next step would be to include, to allow for a for the, how much time do I have?
Actually, we're way past, but
oh, okay, I'll finish really quickly.
I have
a couple more slides, really quickly.
Don't worry.
So just to say that the next step in complexity, here what I looked at was a plasma that's homogeneous and relaxes. Instead of imposing homogeneity, what you can do is to impose boost invariance along the longitudinal direction and homogeneity only along the transverse directions. Okay? This is still not a motional thing. You're ignoring transverse dynamics. But along the longitudinal direction, because in the boost invariant case, the hydrodynamic modes are excited, okay, and in fact, the late time evolution is controlled by hydrodynamics. In that case, at least you can test this linear approximation in a more dynamical setting. And the preliminary work, I can show you the plots if you want, but let me not do it for the sake of time. The preliminary result is that it works almost just as well in that case. Okay, so that's the next step. But let me jump ahead and tell you what I think this might go. Okay, so I said that in a heavy ion collision, people believe that they know something about what the initial state is at t equals 0, meaning really at the moment that these two ions collide with each other. Then there is some time that passes in which very complicated out of equilibrium dynamics takes place. And after that time, you know that you can describe the subsequent evolution with hydrodynamics. But the map between the initial state here, okay, the quantum field theory state for the colliding ions, and the initial state for hydrodynamics here is not known. Okay, and in fact, I don't think anybody has. What people in hydrodynamics do is to basically assume that it's trivial. Okay, that basically what you have here is the trivial extrapolation of what you get here. This is a big assumption, which is crucial for then extracting experimental properties of the plasma. Okay. Now, what can we say about this? Well, the goal here would be if this. The general program would be, suppose that you can collide, you can model or mimic this collision of these two initial ions or pancakes by colliding now. So this is where it comes to the connection with more closely with the closed limit approximation. By colliding two finite energy with compact support lumps in some, say, confining geometry in the best possible scenario, right? But they are finite. You collide them with some impact parameter. And, of course, this pancake will have some, for example, some energy density that depends on the radial direction. So you can also incorporate that here. Then, this is a zoom of what's going on at the bottom of the geometry. The idea would be that there's no possible linear approximation that you can do for the initial dynamics in which these two guys are going against each other and form, at some point, a common horizon. Okay. I'm not claiming that the linear approximation is good for that. But if at some point they form a common horizon, if they do, if they pass by, I have nothing to say. But if they do, then the idea would be that this, the shape or the properties of this initial common horizon will be a very complicated function, perhaps, of your initial data that describes each of these lumps, perhaps. But that once you form this common horizon, its subsequent evolution and relaxation into a thermalized plasma might be controlled, if the closed limit approximation works also here, by the linear approximation. So all the nonlinearity of the problem on the gravity side would be encoded in how you go from the initial data from these two guys to the shape, if you like, of the common horizon. But once you know that, everything else is linear. And this is crucial Because it means, if this linear approximation works, that the superposition principle applies. Okay? So if you form two initial common horizons, let me be very loose here, very sloppy in my terminology. Two common horizons, one here and one here, then if I know the evolution of each of them and the linear approximation works well, then when I form something that's a combination, it's just a superposition of the evolutions. Okay? And I think this may give, once you have all the complexity of hydrodynamics, transverse expansion, and so on, having such a simplifying assumption may be crucial. Because for the case I described, why would you do the linear approximation when you can do the full evolution just as easily, in fact? Okay? But that's because it's a very simple example. When you're looking at something much more realistic, if this works, then it might be the difference between being able to say something general or not. Okay? Because running a full evolution for each collision might be very complicated. But if you can just apply the superposition principle, then that might actually help.